Hello, this is Rin from Home Baking. Lovely to have you here today. Today, we are talking about Brunsfiga and Sweet Focaccia. So, just a reminder that Home Baking is a podcast all about baking at home through the lens of ingredients, history, and culture. Today, we are going to be talking, as I said, about Brunsfiga and Sweet Focaccia. So, essentially, I've been making some dimpled and rich breads with nice toppings. And I'm going to talk a little bit as well about where Brunsfiga comes from and where Sweet Focaccia comes from, because unbeknownst to me, it's actually not just a social media trend. So that's our lovely episode today. I can't wait to get started. I wanted to start off a little bit with some thoughts about Brunsfiga and Sweet Focaccia. So, I came across Brunsfiga a while ago when I was going through my Scandinavian baking obsession, which it's never fully stopped, but I do have sort of phases sometimes. And so, I've been meaning to make it for ages. I kind of really like the idea of something that's much more low maintenance than having to like roll out dough with a rolling pin and then roll it up and then cut it. This is just so much more low maintenance. You basically just make the dough, you pat it out, you put the and then you rise it for the second time, and then you put the fillings on, and then you sorry, and then you dimple it, and then you put the fillings on and bake it. So it kind of cuts out a couple of the steps that you would normally do when you're making breakfast buns. So Brunsfiga comes from Fyn in Denmark, which is a large island. It also incorporates smaller islands as well, I believe. And Fyn is the home of Hans Christian Andersen. It is really, really popular and is made across Denmark and other places too. And it's usually the most of the flavour is just coming from brown sugar. So you normally use like a dark brown sugar. It's really kind of molassesy and flavoursome. It's sometimes made for birthdays as well, and it can be made either in it's sort of typically made either in like a rectangle, as I've done here, or sometimes it's made in the shape of a person, and it can be made for birthdays. And so you it's not realistic. It's, you know, think maybe like more like a gingerbread person type situation. And then if you've made it like that, sometimes people might pretend to be horrified when you cut it up, because you're sort of dismembering the cake man or cake woman. The other thing is, it might also be decorated with icing, it might be decorated with licorice hair, or strawberry laces for hair. But I've chosen to make a rectangular Brunsfiga, so just as simple as possible. You don't even have to roll out, you can just pat it out. And I've also chosen to add cinnamon because I think it goes really well with the brown, dark brown sugar. It's a suggestion from Bronte Orell, who's a Scandinavian baker who's based in London. And it's just, I think it's more delicious having a spice as well as the lovely molasses flavour. And then the other thing that we're making is sweet focaccia. So, focaccia alla genovese is the most commonly known one, I think, which is a kind of like it's a yeast risen but rectangular, so flattish kind of bread. That's where you use absolutely loads of olive oil. And often it's made with rosemary or rosmarino, but not always. You can have other toppings and fillings too. But there's actually quite a lot of different things in Italy that are called focaccia. I was quite surprised by the range of different types of focaccia focaccia. I don't know what the plural would be, actually. Is it focaccia, maybe? Anyway. And it showed me that it's also common, through my internet research, it showed me that it's common to have sweet focaccia in the northwest of Italy. So it's usually an enriched dough that's sprinkled with sugar and or drizzled with honey. And it also might have dried or fresh fruits. It might have nuts. That focaccia veneta or Venetian focaccia uses butter as its fat, and it's actually more of a dome. It's like a kind of, looks like a pasca or like an Easter bread from, or even like a panettone or pandoro. It's really like light and big and domey. So it's not flat at all, which, so I don't really know how it's used. I don't really know what makes a focaccia, if you know what I mean, or where that word comes from. And I also came across something called Piada dei Morti, which kind of translates to flatbread of the dead, which is made for All Souls Day historically. And it's like a circular sweet focaccia from Rimini, made in a circle or a oval. And then it's topped with dried fruit and nuts. So looking at sort of internet comment sections or watching certain TV shows could give you the impression that there's only one way of doing Italian food, there's only one way to make it, there's the correct way and there's the wrong way, and that you have to be very, very precious about it. But actually, my kind of reading on this over the years, because I'm quite, I'm a bit of an Italophile, I really love going to Italy and I'm learning Italian and I really like Italian food, but it's actually not like that at all. It's really varied. There's loads of regional and hyper-regional variations. There's different languages historically spoken in Italy and to an extent to the present day. And also, like, there's no, some of the hard and fast rules that I heard, like things like you don't mix onions and garlic, isn't true for some part. Like, depends on where you are in Italy, and it's not really the case. There's not one singular Italian food culture. And I've found that the more performative it is, the more authentic it tells you it is, the more fake, ignorant, or inauthentic it probably is. And sometimes it's even quite like sort of sinister reasons why that might be the case. So sometimes a sort of false sense of culture might be pushed onto people to satisfy a purpose. So it might be making money, you know, like, this is the most Italian product, you should buy this, or consolidating power even. So there's sort of, some of that obviously is much more, there's a scale, isn't there? So like some of it is much more innocent than others. I'm not saying that Bertolli olive oil is the same as fascism, but the whole idea of a singular Italian culture was sort of pushed heavily in the 20th century, in part by fascists. And the Italy that with the borders that we have today has actually only existed since the mid 20th century. And that's part of the thing, is like, we need to unify all of the supposed ethnic Italians, whatever that means. And sort of have the same language, the same culture, have control over all of these different parts of what we think is Italy. So that's part of the sort of Italianization. But Italy as a state has existed longer than that, but only since the 1860s. So in European terms, that's not very long. So, to give you an example, like, the English monarchy has had a sort of more or less continuous line since 1066. So 1860s is not sort of that recent for Europe. And it's really not that recent in linguistic terms, you know. So some of the languages and dialects of different regions and areas in the state of Italy still persist today. Sicilian is still spoken, for example, but also Italian is still spoken in some places in Croatia. So yeah, and kind of going along with pushing that singular culture and singular identity, singular language, has meant that, as it has in so many other European countries too, the most obvious to me being Spain, repressing minority languages and ethnicities. So, like, you know, this won't be taught in schools. You have to speak this. You have to know, understand this in this language. You can't speak a Slavic language, etc. Also, there was racism behind that as well, and implying that Slavic people are inferior. Anyway, so I'm not suggesting that you should put cream in your carbonara. I don't think that's a good move. I think that egg yolks are far better in that situation. And I'm not saying that people who say that you're messing up your carbonara, like, on the far right. But what I am saying is that there's sort of a huge diversity within Italy and around Italy. And so, yeah, the sort of what is authenticity is always an ongoing debate and discussion in any country. So regardless of all of that, what I've made is just my take on sweet focaccia. It's not authentic whatsoever. It's kind of a mashup of various different recipes, including my favorite, like, enriched dough recipe. But I've added a little bit of olive oil, which, as I said, so focaccia alla genovese, that's olive oil is what makes it, right? But there are other focaccias that don't even have olive oil. But I've added it because it really gave a lovely, lovely texture and a nice flavour to the dough as well. So the way that I'm going to structure the recipe section is we're going to talk about my kind of base recipe for enriched dough. I've spoken about enriched doughs before, so I don't want to sort of bore you. So we'll just sort of cover the basics of that. And then I'm going to talk about a few different toppings that I tried out. So there's the cinnamon and dark brown sugar Brunsviga topping. There's a salted honey topping, which is really special. And there's also a cherry and rosemary topping, which is delicious. So, and quite unusual. So let's talk about those now. Apologies for my slight sniffling, by the way. Periodically, it is hay fever season now. So I'm just, for the next 6 months, I'm just allergic to the air. So it's all good fun. I do manage it well with medication and stuff, but yeah, it's annoying. All right, so for my kind of enriched dough, I've shared a very similar recipe in the past. What I like to do is, but I have slightly made a few adjustments actually. So I was adding butter to it, and I found that it's lighter without adding the additional butter, and you get enough. It's still soft enough from the cream. So I've taken that out, and I use a tiny bit more egg now, and that kind of makes it fluffier. So what it is it 500 grams of white bread flour. So that's just over 2 pounds, to give you a rough idea. And then, or a bit over that. And then it's between 8 and 10 grams of instant or fast action yeast. If I am putting olive oil in, I'd probably do 8 grams. And if I'm not putting olive oil in, I'd probably do 8 grams. If I am, I'd probably do 10 grams because the additional fat slows my rise down. So it just makes it slightly quicker, but you can just use 8 grams as well. That's fine. It might just take slightly longer to prove. 300 milliliters or grams of single cream, which is around 18% fat. This might be called light cream where you are. 2 tablespoons of nice olive oil if you would like. So definitely have this in the cherry and rosemary variation. And then I'd say for the others, it's kind of optional. I think it works quite nicely in any of them actually, but I think for the rosemary cherry, I think it's a must. So 2 tablespoons of a nice olive oil, like a high quality one, if you put drizzle a tiny bit on your hand, try it, and if it tastes fruity and nice, use it. And if it tastes bitter and acrid, maybe try a different one. Two large eggs. I used UK or EU medium, UK or EU large, but it does work as well with a UK EU medium, which is the same as a large in Canada, US, Australia, or you can also use an extra large egg there, which would be roughly equivalent to a UK large. So 50 to 60 grams of sugar, depending on how sweet you want your dough, really. So it depends how much sugar you're going to add to the top as well. Between 50 and 60 is not going to make a huge difference. And then 5 grams of salt, which is about 1 teaspoon of fine salt. So you want to just mix your sugar and salt into the flour, to the dry flour. I always just use a dough hook because then I'm going to knead it using the dough hook, so it's less washing up. Once I've mixed the salt and sugar in well, I mix in the yeast, because it's instant yeast, so you don't need to wake it up beforehand. You can just add it into the flour. Then I heat the cream, usually in the microwave, until it's about 38 degrees Celsius or 100 degrees Fahrenheit. It's better to be slightly too cold than slightly too hot, in terms of if it's a bit cold, it'll just take longer to rise. Whereas if it's too hot, it'll actually potentially even kill the yeast. You want it the same temperature as your body. If you don't have a thermometer, I recently tried to make some bread and it was kind of like a warm bath temperature, and that was too hot and my bread didn't rise properly. So same temperature as your body is what you want, 38 to 43 degrees Celsius. Then you, once you've heated that cream to that temperature, add it to the flour along with the eggs and the olive oil if you're using it, and then mix it until you have a shaggy mixture. Then I usually just cover it with a plate or something, leave it for 10 to 20 minutes so it's easier to knead. Then you want to knead that for between 7 and 10 minutes. If you're using a stand mixer, it'll take a lot longer by hand. And on a kind of lowish setting, so 2 or 2.5, you don't want to go too fast with it because it won't be effective and you will really burn out your motor as well. But what you should observe after that time is it changing texture a lot. It needs to be smooth, coming away from the sides easily. You could even do the window pane test with it. Then you just cover that with a plate or cling film or a shower cap, whatever. Leave it to double in size. And then that should take between about 40 minutes and an hour and a half, depending on the temperature of your kitchen. If you want to slow it down for more flavor, slower fermentation, or because it fits your timetable, then you could put it in the fridge and leave it to rise there. Then once it's doubled in size, you want to grease and line a very large tin with nice high sides. So my tin was about 43 centimeters by 32 centimeters or 17 by 12 and a half inches. If you want to use a smaller tin, you can, but you're going to need to adjust this recipe because it'll make way too much dough. And it might overflow in the oven and the sugar might burn on the bottom of your oven, which is, I can say from personal experience, is not much fun. So pass it out into the tin until it's like touching the sides, then leave it to rise again until almost doubled in size. And again, this could take between 40 and 1 minute, an hour and a half at room temperature, or much longer in the fridge. I really like to sling things in the fridge overnight before I bake them for breakfast, because then you're having it fresh and it's slightly more flavour because it's a longer fermentation. So you get more going on kind of biologically with, you know, things like the lactobacilli bacteria as well as the yeast. Towards the end of that rising time, you want to preheat your oven to 190 C, 170 C Fahrenheit or 375 Fahrenheit. And then you want to put a little bit of oil, water or butter onto your hands and then press your fingers into the dough to create loads of indentations. Then you want to drizzle and drop any toppings and then place it in the oven for about 30 minutes, turning it halfway through if necessary for an even bake. So the reason why you're doing the indentations just before baking is because I found that if I did them halfway through the rise or whatever, then the rise just filled the indentations in. It didn't work. So I think, contrary to a few recipes that I've seen online, you do need to do them just before baking so that you actually can still see the indentations, so that you've got these delicious pools of buttery, sugary goodness. I just found that it worked much better like that. Only thing that I would say is you can also bake from a cold start. So if your dough is almost proof but not entirely, for example, it's actually a really good idea to put it in a cold oven and then set it to the temperature that you want. And then what will happen is, as it's reaching temperature, it'll help prove it just a little bit more. So you can absolutely bake it from a cold start as well, which I think is a really underrated baking method for loads of things. It's also a nice, a gentle way to bake cakes that have a lot of egg whites in, for example. Okay, so that's our kind of base recipe. Then we're going to talk about the toppings. So for the cinnamon and dark brown sugar Brunsviga topping, you want 150 grams of dark brown sugar, 150 grams of butter, unsalted, and a pinch of salt, or you can just use salted butter, and a tablespoon of cinnamon. So I found it easiest to melt my butter, mix in the brown sugar, the salt, and the cinnamon, and then drizzle on top after dimpling and just before baking. With the salted honey, you want 150 grams of unsalted butter. This is so you can control the salt. You could taste it instead if you're using salted butter. Make sure that you've got the right level of salt for you. 100 grams of honey. I really like using a mild blossom honey, something kind of floral but not overpowering. And then a teaspoon and a half of a flaky sea salt such as Malden, plus an extra pinch to sprinkle on top if you like. And then the easiest way I found to prepare this was kind of similarly, melting the butter, stirring in the honey and salt, and then drizzling it on top after dimpling and just before baking. Third and final variation, which I absolutely love, I really highly recommend it. It's kind of somewhere between sweet and savoury, but more on the sweet side. It's floral, it's fragrant, it's fruity. It would also be good with a hunk of cheese, like a pecorino or something salty. And I've used frozen cherries, but you could use fresh if they're in season and they're looking good. But I like to bake cherries from frozen because it means I can have them all year round, and I'm not stressing about using them immediately or whatever. So for the ingredients for this, you want a teaspoon of finely chopped rosemary needles, 150 to 200 grams of frozen pitted cherries, or you can use fresh pitted cherries, 2 tablespoons of nice olive oil, that's in addition to the ones that are going into the dough, 100 grams of butter, so you've got a kind of mixture of butter and olive oil going on here, and 100 grams of granulated or demerara or turbinado or raw sugar, for the crunch. So just a slightly coarser sugar for the crunchiness is nice here. And quite similarly, my preferred way to do this is to melt the butter, mix in the olive oil, and then it slightly departs. So drizzle out the fat all over it, then you sprinkle over the rosemary and the sugar, and then dot the cherries over, and then bake. So this is after you've dimpled, obviously. So the reason why I've done it like this is because I liked the crunch of the sprinkling it over. It's slightly more crunchy than mixing it into the fat. So you get an even distribution of cherries, obviously, as well, and an even distribution of rosemary. So yeah, that's the lovely cherry and rosemary sweet focaccia. It is extremely wonderful. So all that's really left for me to do is tell you what is going to be coming up next. Okay, my lovelies. So I've kind of gone back and forth about what the next episode should be a lot, but I think I want to do one on olive oil and how we can use olive oil in cakes, biscuits, other things too. So obviously we used it in bread kind of in this episode a little bit. So yeah, just olive oil in various sweet treats. And after that, I'm thinking we might do an episode on semifreddo, because there's a few semifreddo recipes I really want to try out. It's a wonderful frozen dessert to make if you don't have an ice cream maker. This summer's coming up and I've never made semifreddo before and I've never talked about it. So I'm looking forward to that one. But yeah, next up is going to be olive oil. So I will talk to you in about a month. All right. See you. Bye. Lastly, tiny bit of housekeeping. So go to homebaking.substack.com if you haven't already signed up for the newsletter, and then you can get the written recipes there as well. It's all free. And also, if you wanted to get in touch with me, it is flour, butter, eggs, sugar, all one word, @gmail.com. So yeah, thanks. Bye.